From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Campaign season's underway for one of Michigan's most contested House seats.
More often than not, almost certainly, the supporting positions that most Republicans are. But I make no secret of that. I'm not pretending to be something else.
Paul Young hopes to take back the district Alyssa Slotkin flipped in 2018. Also, how to know if it's time to check out from social media.
One of the things I always note for myself is when I feel emotional about a story or about a piece of information, that's usually somebody trying to manipulate my emotions for their own ends.
And we bring you the tale of Lottie Wilson, the artist and activist who played a key role in Michigan's suffrage movement.
Lottie really understood this double access of oppression that Black women faced, that they faced racism for being Black and sexism for being a woman.
Her story and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, one of the women who worked to extend full citizenship to all Michiganders.
Native Americans could not vote, Black people could not vote, women could not vote.
It's the story of artist and civil rights activist Lottie Wilson coming up later in the hour. First, we want to bring you up to speed on a key election this year. Michigan is loaded with electoral prizes for both parties. Before the pandemic, we would have said that Michigan's 8th congressional district was going to be a top story this year. Democrat Alyssa Slotkin, who used to work as a CIA intel analyst, flipped the district in 2018 on a razor-thin victory margin. This year, she's facing Republican Paul Young, a former TV anchor who's also spent time as a prosecutor. And last night, they faced off in their first debate of the season. Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott covered the event, and he's been keeping an eye on the 8th throughout this year. Hey, Tyler.
Hey, April. Thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you.
So, what was the tone of this debate last night? Were there any big takeaways that just hit you front and center?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A couple of things first. As much as stuff has changed, this kind of looked like a normal debate. It was just Slotkin and Young, and it was hosted by WLNS TV. So it looked like exactly what you'd expect from people in a studio. But with everything going on this year, obviously the pandemic, social unrest, the first question was about partisanship, and really the first 15, 20 minutes almost of the debate was these two candidates taking aim at each other, trying to differentiate themselves and each other from the party. And it was really interesting. I was wondering what we were going to expect to see from Paul Young, the Republican challenger in the 8th, whose campaign material and a lot of advertising is focused pretty centrally around painting Slotkin as just another Democrat who votes with the party. And if you vote for Slotkin, you're going to end up with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. And on the flip side, Slotkin pressed Young to say, you know, what are the areas where you would disagree with President Trump? And he had a few of those, but it was an interesting opening salvo for sure.
I think I will be honest with the voters when I'm a candidate and say that I have typically conservative Republican solutions to our problem. I won't try to deceive the voters and suggest that I'm somehow independent and not really fully with my party. So, you know, yes, I will probably more often than not, almost certainly, be supporting positions that most Republicans are. But I make no secret of that. I'm not pretending to be something else.
Well, that's interesting. What did Slotkin have to say about her own party affiliation?
Young wanted Slotkin to differentiate herself from her party. And she said, look, there are plenty of times where I voted against my party. And she came out and said what she has sort of always said, that it's her vision of national security issues that come from her time in the CIA and her professional career before politics. And that's kind of how she analyzes everything. And she is a Democrat, but she said, and we have a clip here, that, you know, the way she thinks about making decisions and how she casts her votes isn't based on a partisan rationale.
I don't come into this as a political person. I come into it as someone who is in national security and believes the mission is helping people. And I hope that that same independence is something that Mr. Young could demonstrate. I think that's an important thing.
So that is how they handled the sort of macro lens that a lot of people have when they're looking at this race. And there's plenty to talk about in 2020 in terms of issues in the 8th District. Tyler, what were some of the key policy issues that they wanted to talk about?
You know, I think the first one that got brought up was healthcare. And in fact, it was Slotkin sort of at times taking over the moderator role during the debate to ask Young, Paul, where do you stand on coverage for pre-existing conditions? There's this pending case before the Supreme Court that's going to be heard the week after the election, and the result of that case could result in some portion or all of the Affordable Care Act getting, you know, no longer being part of the law of the land. And with that would go the guarantee for health care coverage for people with pre-existing conditions.
Ah, subtle. I see Slotkin reminding voters there's a Supreme Court seat probably in the balance shortly, too.
Yes, absolutely. And that came up, and Young came out and he said, I do support protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And if that Supreme Court case does away with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, he said he would support separate legislation to bring back coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, which is a big change from the last Republican to hold that seat, who, you know, just a few short years ago, the Republican Party was trying to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Tyler, we know that the 8th Congressional District was important to the Trump campaign's win in 2016, but also, as we saw from the midterms in 2018, voters here are open, at least, to hearing from a Democrat. Could you tell who the voters are that each candidate seemed to be going after last night?
Yeah, you know, since Slotkin won, she's talked a couple different times about wanting to lose better in parts of the district. This is the 8th Congressional is gerrymandered to pretty heavily favor Republicans. Parts of the district are very conservative culturally and politically. And she has tried to cut herself a middle ground as a moderate, as someone who will work with both parties in Congress. She's made a point on many of the bills she's introduced on having at least some Republican co-sponsors. And she's really trying to appeal to people who, for whatever reason, may have voted Republican in the past, but might be open to something else now. At the same time, she does that without too often going explicitly after President Donald Trump's policies. So she's kind of trying to walk that middle line, banking on support from people who are always going to vote Democrat or typically do, but also trying to flirt with people who might be thinking twice about voting Republican. She said last night, or she said in the past, that in order to win, I've got to convince people who voted for Trump to vote for me.
Tell me more about Paul Young. I know that he was a TV anchor and had a brief career as a prosecutor, but I mean, it seems like he's had a lot of different jobs throughout his life.
Yeah, he's had a lot of different hats. He's a guy with roots in Brighton. He's got family. His mom lives in Brighton, and that's where he's at now in the 8th District. He went to the University of Michigan, and he was out in California for grad school. He has kind of jumped around a little bit, was briefly a Trump administration official for Immigration and Customs or in that agency. And it's a first-time political campaign for him, and that's a challenge in this election. When you can't go out and knock on doors like you can because we're in the middle of a pandemic, this is a guy who doesn't have a huge profile in Michigan or locally. And, you know, he's not the incumbent. He's got that hill to climb. And it's the middle of a global pandemic. And he's got to find a way to introduce himself to people who likely have not much of an idea of who he is.
For sure. On Slotkin's side, she seems to have her own set of unique challenges. This is someone who I feel like through 2019 was trying hard to talk about meat and potatoes, kitchen table issues like the economy and healthcare, more recently PPE, you know, and not overtly position herself against President Trump. Is that a stance that you've seen her being able to maintain throughout 2020?
Yeah, I feel like she has, and I feel like there was a pretty direct need for someone to fill that role in, society writ large, really, immediately when the pandemic got bad here in Michigan in the spring. She was pretty quickly hosting events with the regional Small Business Administration official to get tips to small businesses on how to apply for the PPP Forgivable Small Business Loans. She's working on getting legislation through the House now to manufacture more PPE equipment for healthcare providers and frontline workers, keep us safe, manufacture more of that domestically so we don't see the kind of supply shortfalls that we saw in the pandemic. So the kind of pragmatic, everyday issues and problems that have arisen in this pandemic that affect people in the 8th District. I feel like Slotkin has been able to name those issues and kind of grab them as something she's paying attention to and trying to address in some form.
Tyler, do you have any sense of how the voters in the 8th are feeling this time around? Or can you tell if the Republican Party still thinks this district is up for grabs?
I don't know exactly what the Republican Party thinks, but I think there is hopefulness that, you know, this place is just a pretty conservative place. Paul Young, the Republican candidate, didn't win Livingston County in the Republican primary back in August. It went to, you know, kind of a hometown guy who is arguably more conservative than Paul Young is. And I think that kind of character could give people, if you're a Republican hoping for a win, some hope, thinking that, well, this is our neighborhood. He's got a pretty, you know, we just said it's hard to meet people in person in campaign. And Slotkin has also been a very apt fundraiser. So he's at a financial disadvantage when it comes to campaigning, too. But your question about how are voters feeling, I think there's the district goes from Michigan State University in Lansing, a pretty reliable liberal voting ground, to deep red Livingston County. And I feel like you've got slices of everything from the base of the Democratic Party to the base of Trump's party. And then there are two groups that I've heard from a lot over the past year and a half, really, even before the pandemic. There are people who just in general, maybe they're more conservative or see themselves as swing voters, who say the number one thing that's important to me is let's get people in the room who can disagree on issues but reach solutions, you know, return civility to day-to-day politics and not spend time talking about partisanship and attacking one another. And then there are people in the, you know, the heralded suburban voter everybody likes to talk about, who may have been less engaged in politics up until a couple of years ago or whoever, areas where President Trump won. But then, you know, in 2018, we saw this backlash where, you know, Democrats, Alyssa Slotkin was one of them, won and in some cases lost better in those areas that previously favored Trump. So I think there's some appetite for a change in attitude in politics to just get less caustic, but who wouldn't agree with that?
Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott. Hey, Tyler, thanks for checking in on the debate last night and sort of giving us the lay of the land.
Happy to do it, April. Thanks for chatting with me.
Coming up, we confront social media's influence on the 2020 elections.
There are a lot of problems going on in social media right now. Disinformation and misinformation are a huge part of the platforms. And there's a bunch of things that could be done, both legally and technically, but they're very difficult.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The former chair of the Federal Elections Commission published an op-ed for Wired magazine last weekend suggesting that the integrity of 2020's election is in the hands of Facebook and Twitter. If that weren't enough to make you nervous about your feeds, maybe you caught the Netflix documentary The Social Dilemma recently. It traces the speed and degree to which we've all become commodities to big tech, our screen time sold to the highest bidder on platforms that are influencing how we perceive the world.
If technology creates mass chaos, loneliness, more polarization, more election hacking, more inability to focus on the real issues, we're toast.
As the stakes rise, we wanted to talk to Cliff Lampe, a professor of information at the University of Michigan School of Information. He's got thoughts on how we're navigating our social media environment right now. Cliff Lampe, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
How many times this year have you thought about disconnecting?
Probably every 5 minutes. and I did disconnect actually for a week earlier this summer. So it's a good way of cleansing the palate.
Yeah. How'd that go for you?
It didn't go very well. It turns out a lot of my life has been interconnected with social media. And so I came back fairly quickly.
Ann Revell's take is that there's some existential threats right now to the American people's trust in the vote. Also, added dangers that misinformation will continue to lead to violence in the American street, and that both of these facts are because of bad information shared via Facebook and Twitter. Do you think she's overstating the case?
No, I think that there are a lot of problems going on in social media right now. Disinformation and misinformation are a huge part of the platforms. And there's a bunch of things that could be done both legally and technically, but they're very difficult. So it's a really thorny, hard problem to solve.
What do you see as our strongest tools to fight disinformation in the short term?
In the short term, unfortunately, probably is up to the platforms to do something. The Election Integrity Roadmap is a group that have a bunch of recommendations for what we can do with social media. So they have a whole wide set of things, some of which I think are reasonable and some of which are unlikely. But on the reasonable side, pointing to new tools that the platforms are doing, like identifying misinformation or showing alternative viewpoints to a post. Another is to show kind of a history of different groups and if they change names or if they're connected to other groups. Less likely for the platforms are things like turning off the algorithms. All of the platforms make their money basically from, you know, harvesting attention, what Shoshana Zuboff calls the surveillance capitalism. So it's basically the commodification of people's attention and changing their behaviors in order to make profit.
I think even those of us who consider ourselves pretty huge news junkies just have moments where we check in a super cursory way, just take a look at what's going on and move on. And we don't really dive in. We don't really check and source things. Do any of the tools that you're talking about work in scenarios where people aren't engaging very deeply in the news? Maybe they just share without having fully read an article and just go back to their day.
Yeah, there is. I think one of the things to do is self-reflection. So one of the things I always note for myself is when I feel emotional about a story or about a piece of information, that's usually somebody trying to manipulate my emotions for their own ends. So one, I always check in, how am I feeling about a piece of information that I see and what's the motivation of that person for sharing it? So being self-reflective and thinking about what reactions are you having to the things that you're seeing is probably the very first step for us to do something about this.
Which do you see as being more powerful in having an effect on the social sphere, consumer activity or regulation?
That's a very good question. I think consumer activity in the short run is going to be much more powerful. In the long run, I would love to see some regulation of these effects, but that's a very hard sell in our current regulatory environment.
Yeah, the United States has always had a pretty complex relationship with regulation when you look at agencies like the FDA or the EPA. What are some of the challenges to getting an effective regulatory grip over social media with the current environment?
Yeah, they're good challenges, primarily for social media as opposed to something like the FDA. Our biggest challenge is the First Amendment. And I don't mean to say the First Amendment is a challenge, but it's a core principle of American rights and something we should take very carefully and very seriously. When you're talking about regulating social media, you're often talking about regulating the ability of people to speak freely and to share information. So we always need to balance that regulation of social media with those core essential First Amendment rights that we have.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, we've seen at least a little bit more active conversation about this going on just among users. If whether or not there's a change in Washington at the presidential level next year, do you see maybe the federal government or Congress getting more serious about this?
I think they will in a few ways. You've seen some conversations about ways to regulate some of the social media companies that aren't going to impinge individual free speech or liberty. I think you see a lot of conversation about if we don't regulate it, then what we're basically doing is leaving all of those speech rights up to the social media companies themselves, who are not a regulatory body and to whom we don't have any ability to have redress. So I think you start to see those conversations on both sides of the aisle in Congress lately. And so it'd be interesting to see how this unfolds over the next couple of years.
A cynic would say that there really isn't as much reason for a party in power to consider a change in regulation of social media. Do you think that that's oversimplifying things?
Probably a little bit, only because I think we're seeing a whole lot of effects outside of even the partisan landscape. So conspiracy theories and violence are rising across social media platforms, radicalization and formation of extremist groups. So even outside of kind of pushing an election one way or the other, I think we see a lot of potentially negative effects coming out of social media that I hope any party would hope to curtail.
A lot of us know people who have dropped off of social media. Do you think that that has happened in a way that gives some of the big internet titans any pause to think about the way that they're doing things? Or are these movements just so small that it doesn't really make any difference in their business models?
Sadly, I think it's the latter, especially given that most of the growth for most of the social media companies isn't in the United States at this point. So having a few people in the United States drop off of social media platform, and typically when people are dropping off, they're dropping off one or another. They're typically staying with some type of social media in their lives, just picking which one they want to be on. So far, I haven't seen that being a critical mass enough to have any effect on policy at the companies.
What about some of the regulatory efforts that have been taken in Europe? I mean, these steps are not gigantic when you look at how they've been applied. But do you think that's gotten the attention of companies like Facebook and Google?
Absolutely. And in fact, most of the companies have been very supportive of the regulations in Europe. A lot of these companies have been begging for more regulation because they can't necessarily manage this on their own and don't want to be held responsible for managing it on their own. So I think a lot of the companies, from what they said publicly, would love to see more regulation in this space and have pointed to Europe as an example for that.
Tell us what you want us to do. Save us from our own business model.
Or at least make it so that we have cover if we want to do something, right? So if we do have to do something, you know, cover us so we're not solely responsible for making these unpopular decisions.
You know, I hear sometimes from people that say, I'd like to unplug. I really would. It drives me nuts. But I kind of have to be on social media for work. And it's certainly the case that every company, every brand has to have a social media presence to be taken seriously in almost every field right now. To what extent do you think the corporate environment is driving the longevity of our social media platforms?
I don't think it's that much. Definitely that's a part of it, in that for a lot of people, their work is interconnected with social media. That's still probably a small amount of the workforce in total. When my students and I discuss whether social media is good for us or bad for us, one of the things we always come back to is the bad things are flashy and showy, and the good things are mundane and happen every day and happen so regularly, we don't often notice them. So I think when we look at the good versus the bad in social media, it's easy to overlook the good. And people are fairly rational. They wouldn't be coming back to social media if it weren't having some good effects for them. But the bad can be so flashy and such an event that's what we pay attention to. So I think part of why we keep coming back to social media is that there's a lot of reason to be there.
The Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, pointed out that part of what contributed to the problem and continues to do so today is the incredibly narrow range of voices running the show at some of the larger platforms. And I think that's meant in terms of the actual diversity in the room, the number of women, the number of people of color who are involved, and just the diversity of thought and diversity of attitudes toward what the end game of a product should be. How serious do you think Silicon Valley is about changing that?
Over the past few years, they've gotten a lot more serious. I know a lot of companies have invested in research teams that are now going across the globe to learn more about users' experiences in different parts of the world. So it's something that they have come to in the fairly recent past. Are they all the way there yet in terms of incorporating those voices, especially at kind of an executive decision-making level? Probably not. But that's one of the biases of The Social Dilemma as a movie, is that they're looking at a particular period of time for these social media companies and the effects of that time. I'm not sure that they're kind of looking at where Silicon Valley is right now. Not to apologize for Silicon Valley, but I do think they're aware of the problem more so, even if they're not fully grappling with it.
Do you use the word inextricable when you talk about how social media is intertwined with our lives these days?
I wouldn't use inextricable. I would say important, right? I don't think it's inextricable. I think you can leave social media if it really is bothering you. And for a certain number of people, it can be pathological. So those people should protect themselves and do what they need to do. For a lot of us, it does have a lot of benefits in our lives and helps us to connect, especially in a pandemic world where it's hard to connect necessarily with people like we used to.
Yeah,
we do see a lot of people connecting through social media and getting a lot of social support through those channels. So for me, a lot of it depends on how you use social media. One of the most common findings in my field is passive consumption usually is associated with more negative effects, but active consumption, i.e. reaching out to friends, communicating, being a good person and talking to people in a civil way, all can have more positive effects for people.
You know, one of my summer reads was Ron Chernow's A Biography of Alexander Hamilton. Not that I got through it because it's a 900-page book, but I gave it a go. And I was really interested reading about the press at the dawn of the United States. And when we think about the ways we've communicated over that time, or even the way we communicated through media at the turn of the last century, one of the golden ages of newspapers. There were huge economic disparities. There were lots of small voices, small newspapers with agendas. And, you know, sometimes a more radicalized approach to different ideas or a radicalized approach to, you know, how who was speaking for the economically disadvantaged in this country. Have we really come that far?
Not really that far. I often point to that time period because if you look at around the time of Hamilton, papers were brutal towards opposition candidates. And it was really, for 100 years there, it was really tough to be in politics, given the way that papers attacked people.
There was disinformation. There were conspiracy theories abroad and both domestically. I mean, it was all there.
It was all there, yeah. And one of the things that I think was dissatisfying for me for the Social Dilemma movie was that at the end of the day, they blame the companies and surveillance capitalism for all of these ill effects in society. And I think that's letting humans off the hook a little bit too easily. We've had these tendencies no matter what media we've been using, and we need to work against those tendencies of misinformation and conspiracy theorizing in really diligent, really wholehearted ways. And it doesn't feel like we're doing that part, the human part. The technology part we can address through regulation and through technological fixes. But I think if we just assume that it's technology making us do bad things, that's never going to really address the problem.
Cliff Lampe is a professor of information at the University of Michigan School of Information. Cliff, I know it's going to be a long rest of the year, so thank you for helping us think about some guidelines for surfing through it.
Thanks so much.
The Great Lakes fishing industry is still reeling from the pandemic. Congress was supposed to help out a lot. The intention was to set aside hundreds of millions of dollars for fishers across the country. When it came time to dish out that money, the Great Lakes did not end up seeing a dollar.
I was totally not surprised that nobody gave a second thought to the Great Lakes commercial fishery period. It's like nobody wants us. Everyone forgets about us.
Interlochen Public Radio's Lexi Krupp takes the story from here.
When the pandemic hit, commercial fishers in the Great Lakes had a big problem. Many deal in thousands of pounds of fish each season, selling to markets in Chicago and New York and across the world. And those buyers all close shop.
The big processors shut down completely and were accepting no fish.
That's Amber Peterson, owner of The Fishmonger's Wife, based in Muskegon. She says the timing here really matters, because the spring is one of the best times to catch whitefish, the most valuable fish in the Great Lakes. And that's just when COVID began to overwhelm the nation.
So we had reports of commercial fishermen in Michigan who had a catch with absolutely nowhere to sell it.
But there was a plan to help fishers get through this. Big federal dollars from the COVID relief funding passed in March, the CARES Act. That set aside $300 million for fisheries across the country. Whitney Gravel, attorney for the Bay Mills Indian community, was in touch with federal administrators, hammering out details about the funding.
We know our fishers need help. How can we help you help us?
And then she got the news.
So in one fell swoop, where there was this anticipation and need for relief under the CARES Act, it was denied due to an interpretation from the federal agency.
Fishers in the Great Lakes wouldn't qualify for any of this money. And the reason why gets a little wonky. The federal agency distributing this funding, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. That's important because NOAA is in charge of waters like the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, while the Great Lakes are managed by states. So NOAA said, sorry, we actually can't give you any piece of this COVID relief pie. And members of Congress said, no, no, no. When we wrote this bill, we wanted the Great Lakes to share in this funding.
NOAA countered by saying, well, we do not have jurisdiction over the Great Lakes.
Whitney says for tribal fishers especially, this decision has been devastating because commercial fishing is a guaranteed right under treaties with the federal government.
It was kind of a double slap in the face. Why would you not support that treaty right with federal assistance.
And many tribal commercial fishermen, they might not qualify for some of the other assistance programs out there, like loans from the Small Business Administration or the Paycheck Protection Program.
Commercial fishermen got nothing. They couldn't even get unemployment, so they went down to nothing.
That's Richard Peterson, chairman of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, in northern Wisconsin. He told me that a lot of the fishers in his community, they've been doing this for generations. And now?
I've seen one of them cutting grass.
Members of Congress from the Great Lakes do know about this. They're trying to make sure the Great Lakes fisheries are included in the next round of COVID relief funding. But right now, Ohio Representative Marcy Kaptur, co-chair of the Great Lakes Task Force, says their main focus is keeping the lights on.
And they can't reach agreement on that.
So no one is holding their breath for this federal money. Amber Peterson of the Fishmonger's Wife says her hopes lie in the water.
I don't know a family who's not going, oh God, we hope that fall fishery is good. We hope that fall fishery is good. We hope the fall fishery is good.
Once the water cools back down, whitefish are easier to catch. So fishers have another season to make up some of the money lost this spring, an estimated $50 million. Many can't afford to lose any more. I'm Lexi Krupp.
It's been 100 years since women gained the right to vote in America. We'll hear about the life of one black suffragette from Michigan who spent her life pushing for racial and gender equality. That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This year, as dozens of lawsuits in dozens of states challenge or try to preserve Americans' access to the ballot, we got to thinking about a Michigander who fought about as hard as anyone for those voting rights. Charlotte Lottie Wilson was an artist, a suffragette, and a civil rights activist who lived and worked in the early part of the 20th century. At a time when solidarity between black and white activists was an upfront tension. The Michigan History Center's Jillian Reese joins us now with her story. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, April.
Lottie Wilson was first and foremost an artist, right? I mean, she was the first black student to graduate from the Art Institute of Chicago. What can you tell us about her early life and her career?
Lottie was born in Niles, Michigan in 1854. Her family was just an average middle-class family. She was very involved in the local community, and her family was very well known in Niles. Her family emphasized formal education, and they wanted to give Lottie the opportunity to do whatever she wanted, and she wanted to be a working artist.
What was her medium?
She did almost anything. So she would teach art classes. She painted on porcelain and china, create sculptures for commissions. And then she also painted portraits. She did local portraits, portraits of Black Americans that were well-known nationally. She donated a number of paintings to important organizations for Black Americans like the Tuskegee Institute and Provident Hospital in Chicago.
Tell me a little bit more about how her interest in politics grew. It sounds as though her family was pretty involved in civic life in Niles, but how do you get from there to being on the front end of the suffrage movement?
I think, you know, when you're a woman sort of trailblazing in a profession that was really closed off to women, there weren't very many women who made their living as an artist. She kept her maiden name her entire professional career. I think that you have a lot of chutzpah and you are really motivated, I think, to push forward in other areas. So, you know, in addition to being an artist, she wanted to be involved in her community. You know, she was a member of the National Association of Colored Women, which was a women's rights and suffrage organization that was created in part because of the segregation that Black women faced in suffrage organizations. She was a member of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. She was a member of the Afro-American Council, which is a precursor to organizations like the NAACP. And she was also involved in philanthropy. She was a trustee of the Phyllis Wheatley House in Detroit, which was a settlement house for African-Americans who were arriving in Detroit from the South during the Great Migration. And I think that shows sort of this network. She's in Niles working as an artist, but she's still involved in civil rights organizations in the city of Detroit.
So here was Lottie Wilson, really an amazing figure and such a trailblazer in so many ways. But at the same time, like, how would you describe the barriers that she would have experienced that excluded her from full citizenship at that time as a Black woman?
When Michigan achieved statehood, we had some of the most liberal voting laws in the United States, but Native Americans could not vote, Black people could not vote, women could not vote. After the Civil War, Native American men could vote and Black men could vote, but not women. But in addition to that, this was a woman who was moving around the state, was moving around the country, going to other places to talk about suffrage and civil rights, to work on art. And when she was moving around the United States, she would have met with a patchwork of laws that we call Jim Crow laws now, which were laws that were created after the end of the Reconstruction that were meant to limit the movement and the rights of Black Americans. There were many things outside of Michigan that she would have faced that would have reminded her of her second-class citizen status.
What would you say was the sort of touchstone for her when the movement would have really picked up steam?
In 1899, the National American Woman Suffrage Association held their annual convention in Grand Rapids. The National American Woman Suffrage Association was the number one national suffrage organization.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before. This was a pretty storied moment, certainly in Michigan women's suffrage, but also nationally speaking, too.
Yes. And the National American Women Suffrage Association discouraged Black women from attending their conventions in an effort to appease white suffragists from Southern states who did not want an integrated convention. They did not want to have to mix and mingle with Black women at this convention. But the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs would still send members to this national convention despite the tensions, because they knew that this was the number one organization. They wanted to have representation, even though they knew they weren't welcomed there.
To think about that kind of open hostility to Black women is just really startling. I mean, can you set the scene for us? Is there anything that we know of, you know, what the tone of those meetings were like, given that there were, you know, there were Black women there who said, we're not going to stop organizing. And, you know, and we do insist on our place at the table here.
I want to be frank. I think Black people in the United States are very sadly familiar with this feeling of being ostracized, of being left on the table for political advancement. For the leaders of the woman suffrage movement, particularly, you know, women like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Anna Howard Shaw, they saw the tabling of Black women or ostracizing Black women as a way to achieve their goals politically. While at the same time, you know, they also supported ideas of white supremacy. They also wrote about the fact that it was, you know, an abomination that Black men got the right to vote before white women. You know, there are telegrams, letters out there from these leaders to politicians in the South who used integration as a reason to not support women's suffrage, saying that when they were fighting for women's suffrage, they were not fighting for Black women to get the right to vote. They wanted to make that really clear so that these Southern politicians would end up supporting an amendment to the Constitution to give women the right to vote. They said, we won't interfere in what you want to do in the South. So Black women would have been very aware of this. And I think it shows a lot of the resiliency of Black women when it comes to political organizing. And this has been true from almost the entirety of the history of the United States, you know, seeing barriers put up, but then pushing forward and confronting those barriers in a very courageous way, which is what Lottie Wilson did.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is the Michigan History Center's Jillian Reese. We're talking about West Michigan artist and suffragette Lottie Wilson, who battled to get Black women the right to vote in Michigan. What came out of the convention?
These conventions, they happened annually. And throughout the convention, women would present resolutions on a range of women's issues. So this was a suffrage organization, but they were really a feminist organization. They would talk about suffrage. They had resolutions about equal pay, resolutions about divorce, domestic violence, temperance, education for women. On the second to last day, Lottie presented a resolution about segregation on rail cars. At the time, women and families who traveled by train would travel in so-called ladies' cars. And this was a place where smoking and drinking were prohibited. Oftentimes, the interiors of these cars were much more lush than the regular cars. But in many places in the United States, Black women could not buy tickets to these ladies' cars, no matter what their socioeconomic status was, no matter what their occupation was. They could not ride in these cars. Sometimes they would buy a ticket on the ladies' cars, like in the North. And then as they traveled through different jurisdictions with Jim Crow laws, they would be moved to a smoking car. And what that really said, and you know, this goes back to sort of Sojourner Truth's Am I a Woman speech, like the common thought of the time was that Black women weren't ladies, that Black women, because of their Blackness, could not achieve that genteel lady sort of feeling. And, you know, they had to be segregated. They were different than white women. And traveling by rail cars, which was the major way that people traveled during this time, to be told that you aren't a lady no matter what your social status is, no matter where you come from, what your family did, was something that was very offensive to a lot of Black women and was a major focus. This ladies' car and being able to ride in ladies' cars was a major focus of Black suffragists and feminists of the time. So Lottie's resolution stated that she resolved that colored women ought not to be compelled to ride in smoking cars and that suitable accommodations should be provided for them. That was it. That was the statement. And she wasn't even calling for integration. She was just saying, we want some accommodations, like make a ladies' car for Black women so we don't have to sit in the smoking cars. This was a national convention. There were a lot of Southern delegates there who attacked Lottie. They said this wasn't the goal of this convention, that, you know, they didn't want to speak about these issues. They were irrelevant. Remember, they were talking about a whole host of other issues, but this was a women's issue, the segregation, but it wasn't a white woman's issue. They were really against her even bringing it up. There were some other delegates, like the daughter of the famous abolitionist, the Blackwells, Alice Stone Blackwell was there. And she came to Lottie's defense and sort of said, we should care about the rights of all women, not just white women. Susan B. Anthony, who is the chair of the meeting, she dismissed the resolution. She said this resolution was outside of the National American Woman Suffrage Association's influence, that they couldn't do anything about it, that this wasn't a women's issue. And she ended the debate before it got too heated. And this is kind of typical of those meetings. Black women would try to bring their concerns to the table, and then they were told by the leadership that that wasn't really a concern for this convention.
Mm-hmm. How did that set the tone for the course her activism took in later years?
Lottie really understood this double access of oppression that Black women faced, that they faced racism for being Black and sexism for being a woman, and sometimes classism depending on their socioeconomic class. I think she really focused her art. She wanted to meld her art with politics. She wanted to use her creativity to uplift the Black community and Black culture. One of her most famous paintings, and actually was the first painting to be accepted into the White House's collection that was by a Black artist, was a reinterpretation that she did of a painting of a meeting between Sojourner Truth and Abraham Lincoln. This meeting, actually, we don't know if it actually happened, which is a whole nother story. Mm-hmm. But the image shows Lincoln and Truth holding the so-called Black Bible that was given to Lincoln by Boston's Black community. And her choosing Sojourner Truth, this woman that was known and has become sort of the personification of this tension for Black women between their Blackness and their womanhood, that Sojourner Truth's famous "Aren't I a Woman" speech really talks about that tension that, you know, I'm treated and brutalized like a man, but I'm a woman and I'm not given the same sort of femininity that white women are given. And I think it's really interesting Lottie ended up choosing Sojourner Truth as a subject, but then also that this was the painting that she has become most known for now.
Jillian, did Lottie Wilson sort of step back and rest on laurels after the 19th Amendment was passed?
No, she continued to work on behalf of civil rights organizations. You know, in Michigan, when the 19th Amendment passed, Black women were given the right to vote. But again, the support of Jim Crow and Jim Crow policies really affected millions of women. And after the 19th Amendment, there were millions of women in the United States that could not vote. There were laws against Latinas and Native Americans voting in the Southwest and the West Coast. And of course, in the South, there were laws passed to stop Black women to vote. And so Lottie Wilson still was involved in women's issues. She supported things like the Equal Rights Amendment, but she also was very involved with the NAACP, with, like I said, the National Association of Colored Women, these groups that were really focused on dismantling Jim Crow and advocating for the true installation of these voting laws.
Jillian, I know that the Michigan History Center has been also talking about Lottie Wilson because of an upcoming exhibition. Can you tell us when we should look for that?
Right now, we are closed due to, obviously, the COVID-19 closures in the state of Michigan. But we are, when we reopen, we are going to be opening a new temporary exhibit called I Voted. And we started this exhibit because we wanted to commemorate the passage of the 19th Amendment. We just celebrated a month ago the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. But we want to include the entirety of voting rights and voting history in Michigan so that we can sort of stretch out this story so it's not so focused on this narrative about the white leaders of the American suffrage movement, that we can include, you know, the activism around getting Native Americans the right to vote, African Americans the right to vote, women the right to vote, expansion of voting in the 20th century and access to voting. So Lottie is a character in this story, and she's one of the many sort of ordinary people that we want to focus on to show how voting rights have moved and evolved in Michigan.
Jillian Reese is with the Michigan History Center. Jillian, thank you so much for sharing Lottie Wilson's story with us.
No problem. Thanks.
As we leave you today, we remind you that Kamala Harris is visiting Michigan today. Joe Biden's pick for vice president is visiting Flint and Detroit. We noticed that Senator Harris has been attracting much attention on the campaign trail, not just for her stump speeches, but for her footwear. We definitely approve of her sneaker of choice, the Chuck Taylor All-Stars, but those Timberlands, I don't know, could we get her in something a little bit more local? Maybe a pair of Wolverine work boots or some Merrells? I mean, the hush puppies would be so easy on the feet after weeks of pounding the campaign pavement, but somehow that doesn't seem like her style. What about trading in those Timberlands for a Carhartt jacket? Fashion forward, but it still says, I'm not afraid to get grimy. While you're enjoying the fit, Senator Harris, Congressman Kildee would like a word with you about the PFAS byproducts of the shoe trade. We'll spend some more time on the candidates and their surrogates and what they've had to say to Michigan later this week. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.